Right, which is from our first survey in 2002, which shows basically the prevalence of male circumcision in the various provinces of our country. And what is clear from this is that overall, there is a low level of male circumcision compared to other countries. But perhaps let me take one step back. Why is this an important issue? There have been a number of studies which have been done which has shown that male circumcision is partially effective in preventing HIV infection among males. And hence, it's important to be able to find out what is the state of affairs. And this does have policy implications because as of this year, the government has decided actually to roll out medical male circumcision. And from this map, you will see that three of the provinces have very low, well, relatively low, prevalences of male circumcision, namely Northern Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, and in Mpumalanga. Right? In terms of the percentages which are shown there. Now, what's important is that, in fact, in terms of what government has prioritized, in fact, those three provinces will be targeted first. What are the policy implications? We are aware last year during World AIDS Day that the president did announce a new treatment criteria that would elevate the CD4 cell count from 200 to 350. As well, there's currently this HCT, which is HIV counseling and testing campaign, which has been initiated. It will be officially launched on Sunday, I think, by the president, and next month in the various provinces by the premiers. Now, this will obviously lead to an enormous increase in the number of people who require ARV treatment. We estimate about 5.5 million South Africans are living with HIV and AIDS. I just indicated earlier that only about 1 million are under treatment. But that was using the odd cutoff point of 200 CD4 cell counts. But of course, part of the challenge that we have been facing is that many people wait until it is too late to seek services. But if this new campaign, the HIV counseling and testing campaign, is successful, there are going to be many more people, maybe twice as much as currently are on treatment, who will need to go on treatment, and that has got an implication on resources. Equally, as I said, part of the fight is also to prevent there being new infections taking place. So government has actually also, through SANAC, indicated their intention to also prioritize prevention efforts. And one of those interventions being pushed to the fore is male circumcision. Because of the evidence that has been obtained from research and also the fact that UNAIDS and WHO recommend that we roll out this intervention as soon as possible. However, it's important to emphasize that the idea is not to see this as a standalone intervention. It's not just about male circumcision, the physical act of cutting, but it is to be seen as part of a package which addresses other sexual and reproductive issues concerning men. A challenge that is still there is the issue of how to create synergy between traditional and medical types of male circumcision. All right. I did mention about the three provinces which are being prioritized for implementing medical circumcision. In particular, KwaZulu-Natal has developed a full plan, the only province that I'm aware of from a national meeting we had 3 weeks ago, to have done so. And the momentum really came from a proclamation by His Majesty Goodwill Zwelithini, who removed the cultural ban on male circumcision, which had lasted for over 200 years among the Zulus. And the challenge here, in terms of appropriation, is that actually part of the discussion happening nationally is there isn't much funding that has been actually allocated to this particular initiative. Yet it is one of the key responses that our country actually has agreed to implement. As a result, we actually relying more on donor funding for initiating the process. Now, going back directly to the appropriations bill, looking through some of the allocations, we welcome that the increased allocations to HIV and AIDS in general, and I've given several examples there. Of where funding has been allocated. And as I indicated, when you look at the health budget allocations, there are also allocations for human resources and also for improving quality of health services. Here, it's important to note that the minister has sorry about that. I don't know what happened there. What did I do? Resume slideshow. That the minister has actually advocated that we try to replace the expensive drugs that we have been using hitherto. It's really where they're sourced from. And they are going to go on the wider market. And this has important implications for our ability in future of having to cope with the massive numbers that might come forward requiring treatment. So the increase in the allocation is welcome, but even further, this other initiative by the Department of Health would ensure that even more people will be able to access treatment, and hopefully we won't witness some of the stockouts as occurred last year in a few provinces. All right, I'll try to sum up and give a chance to Dr. Jacobs. Other departments, notably, are also allocating resources for HIV and AIDS. I think that needs to be acknowledged. Particularly Love Life, which also gets an allocation through the health budget. I think this is showing that some indigenously developed interventions are sustainable. Love Life started using donor funding, and now we're at a stage where our own government is providing support for the important work that they must do, particularly among the youth in the country. Social development also has been allocated a fair amount of funds, and what's important is to see that the bulk of those funds will be passed on to the recipients, at least according to my reading of the bill. This is indeed important because this is how we are able to mitigate the problem of orphans and vulnerable children. Science and technology actually also have an allocation for HIV and AIDS prevention and treatment technologies. The allocation is relatively low, and in terms of the needs, and the focus there is on technologies. I think there's a great need for research that will look into more social and structural factors, including social norms, to help us in furthering the fight against HIV. Currently, most of the funding supporting such research is actually from foreign governments through PEPFAR, for example, as well as international institutions. And I think this is an area where there might be some improvement. Also, notably, basic education continues to allocate a fair amount towards HIV/AIDS rescues education. And this is important work, and some of the evidence from our research really shows that we're beginning to turn the tide where young people are concerned. And it's probably as a result of cumulative effects of all these interventions that are being implemented. I will stop there and give a chance to my colleague to continue. Thank you.
Professor Mbai, it's a pity that we have an enemy, an abstract enemy called time. You know, that is a very interesting matter. Over to you, Dr.
Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning, all the other members of this committee. I have a very difficult task to fit in two areas of the presentation, which is, of course, dealing with and linked to a key. Priority defined as priority number two, which is rural development, agrarian reform, land reform, and food security. So I'll try my best to fit that into the available time so that we can have sufficient discussion. My focus is going to be more on the context, trying to get to the impacts of some of the interventions rather than looking at some of the good work that the PSC will be presenting in their presentation, looking at specific allocations. Now, that first point is basically stating that there is this close linkage between rural development and food security or food insecurity, and that a certain percentage of smallholder farmers, they very actively produce food, both for households, as well as food that they distribute, small surpluses, through the market. However, we have 40% of the population, more or less, in rural areas, but only 10% of them on average being economically active. This gap between population share in rural areas and those who are economically active, you find a huge gap specifically in a province like Limpopo. We found that some of our research, and it's revealed in this publication that I just distributed, I've got a lot of copies in my office, and I can always make that available, that 80% of the rural population appear to be involved in agriculture. They're not being picked up in the formal official surveys. Now, and in some countries, even in developed countries, this is close to the area of about 25%. Now, this is not necessarily the case across South Africa. Some parts of some provinces, you don't have people active in or people classified as rural. But the economic participation of these people, and this is the key point of the slide, is generally very low, especially in the former homelands, where we have found that there is a severe underutilization of productive agricultural land. So what are the policy implications of some of these things? There has been an expansion in the, I think, amount of money is allocated to rural development, and it's a new department, actually, kind of siphoned off from the previous the pre-2009 administration within the Department of Land Agriculture and Land Affairs. It's now standalone. This increase is, however, still, I think, fairly small if we look at the specific challenges that I tried to highlight in the previous slide, the huge gap between economic participation and people involved in agriculture or living in the rural areas. A specific concern is the amount of money that is being allocated to what is referred to as post-settlement support by a lot of people. I prefer to call it agricultural development support, and we can discuss that distinction later. If you just use a simple example, that in 2008 and 2009, the average agricultural expenditure per landed household was about 3,700 rand. And it's very easy to estimate how that particular figure. Just take the total number of people that we know are actively involved in agricultural farming activities. And then, of course, we divide that figure into the total amount of budget allocated for agricultural expenditure, excluding, of course, the amounts going to administration, specifically focusing on the agricultural development support component. Interventions that require critical attention, we highlight as, you know, dealing with access to water resources and investigating low-cost technologies of increasing access to water. Land management and environmental care, the issue around, and this is an old issue, and I've raised this on a previous occasion when I made a presentation here, around access to agricultural extension support. A lot of the agricultural extension support today that are being provided to those people active in farming come via the Commodity Producers Association, and there is a distinct difference between the quality of extension coming through the Commodity Producers Associations and those coming via the existing Departments of Agriculture, where we have a much smaller number of people actually providing agricultural extension. There is need for increasing expenditure on R&D, specifically on various types of technologies, and we are working with the department at the moment to explore more kind of user-friendly or appropriate, what we call appropriate technologies for farmers in these different locations. The South African agricultural setup has a very bizarre setup with regard to the transportation of food and agricultural produce. You live in Limpopo, you have to come and sell the stuff in the Johannesburg Fresh Produce Market. We need to have, and also the processing facilities, and this is what our latest research has shown, they're all located mainly in urban centers, in urban locations. The agricultural processing must be brought closer to the agricultural regions, and that will reduce, you know, both transportation costs, but also, and this is, I think, there's some need for research in that particular area, the carbon footprint, which is a critical concern. We are concerned, of course, about issues around the increases in fertilizer and other input costs and equipment costs, and that is likely to increase with increases in oil and fuel prices. And the notion of peak oil is necessarily going to drive fertilizer, which uses a lot of the fuel-based ingredients, higher. We've got to do more in line with the Agricultural Marketing Act, trying to incorporate smallholder farmers into a growing export market. We have to deal with the area and domain of support for skills development. We are in the process of working with the Department of Rural Development on crafting a rural development skills or human resource development initiative. There should also be, as I mentioned already, some investment in agro-industrial logistics, improving the quality specifically of rural we are concerned that it is very hard to get accurate information on the extent of smallholder farming production, and for that we need an improvement in the M&E system. There has been a major improvement, I think, since 2009 with the development of the Comprehensive Rural Development Program. The Comprehensive, the CRDP, has become essentially a platform that's trying to address the rural challenges from three different angles. The one area is agrarian transformation, the other one is rural development, and the final leg is known as land reform. An overarching thematic thrust of the CRDP, and especially its implementation since 2009, has been to fast-track what we refer to as rural development pilot sites or nodal development. And there are a number of these different nodes that are already, you know, existing nodes, and the department is in the process of gathering additional information in looking at the impact of interventions in these specific nodal areas. A further development, I think, that is very, very positive is the development and towards a new kind of white paper on agrarian transformation, rural development, and land reform, and a green paper is to be tabled in cabinet shortly. In this green paper, I think there are three very important areas that will overcome some of the inherited institutional and other challenges. The first one is the Rural Development Agency to coordinate rural development interventions across in different provinces and different areas of interventions, whether that be municipal level and provincial level, to overhaul the land policy framework and consolidate all land-related laws and legislation, ranging from the point of land acquisition right through to the area of land management and utilization. There is also, in this specific green paper discussion around, the proposed green paper discussion around, the revision of legislation around farm worker tenure issues. And what is being put forward, and the emerging discussion is to have a combination of the old ESTA and the Labor Tenants Act. There is an ongoing controversy around the position and role of traditional leadership in land reform and rural development, and this requires, I think, some urgent attention. A specific issue that needs to be addressed, linked to the 3,700 per landed household that's being spent on agricultural development support, is the current intervention of the land reform recapitalization intervention, and there is a strong strategic thrust or emphasis on that. But this seems to be at the moment still distinct from the comprehensive agricultural support package, which is distributed through the Department of Agriculture, Forestry, and Fishing. And how do we combine these interventions on the recap with CASP in order to enhance, sustainable rural livelihoods? And that's where I'll end. Thanks.
That's fine.
Okay.
Thank you very much. But if we need, we still have more time in terms of days, not today. I mean, we'd also like to invite your other sectors, you know, other sections within HSRC, but to ask those presentations are very important. They are critical to this appropriation. Another melon. I'm in your hands. Can I see who wants to speak? The Honorable Honorable Sarabi. Are you ready? Comment? Okay. In that point.
Thank you, Chair. There was a program on SABC2 on Monday evening with regard to farms that were transferred, you know, in terms of the land reform program, and those farms are just totally derelict. I mean, there was one guy that managed to farm there and just made a living. Now they've got, I think something like 1,000 people they want to feed from the same farm. Not possible. And what worries me the most, Chair, is that those farms are now derelict. I mean, and 95% of the farms that have been actually transferred in terms of these programs are not operative. But the most worrying thing of the whole issue is that it came out during that program that last year, for the first time in 35 years, this country had to import food. It was a net importer of food, which means that our food security is going down the drain. And that, to me, is an extremely worrying factor. Because if we don't do something very quickly with regard to, you know, what this gentleman doctor has said here, with regard to, you know, getting the people who receive farms to make sure that they get the assistance afterwards once they've got the farms to know how to farm, you know, and get the implements and get the money to actually farm. You need as much as the cost of the farm to actually start farming. This is what it's all about. They don't get it. So if we don't do that, you know, and I'd just like to hear the remarks from these two gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I think it was an excellent presentation here this morning. Especially, I'm more focused on the rural development side. There's only 3 points. It's on page 9. And I think that's very important for the success of food production in the future. That is the one of research and development. The other one is the attention to input costs and the fertilizer and equipment. And the third one is the agricultural trend conscious. I think that's very important for the future of food production. And I also want to know what is the comments on how they will address that. Because I know that there were certain colleges that were closed. And I know there are certain colleges who haven't got enough equipment, enough bursaries for students. And I think that is a big thing. What is my biggest concern, and I think if we look at these 3 points, I want to know, how are you going to address the situation to bring more of the young generation who were on the farms, the young farm workers who have the passion, the feeling of farming in hands, to bring them back? Because there is the perception that when you are working on a farm, you know, negative perceptions about, my father was a farm worker, I don't want to go again. I want to go to the lights of the cities. That is, I was a farmer, but son of a farmer. And I know that these challenges that farm workers today have. So we must make it also more acceptable for farmers to say, listen, that is the situation we must urgently look at. But the big thing is, farmers will tell you today, the input costs are tremendous. And also, if you look at, that's my point, if you, at the second one I mentioned, the fertilizer and equipment. If you look what the prices, the increase of prices of equipment, tremendous. The grain farmers, and I think Pierre is in that area of the overbuck, he will tell you more about that. But when you look at this, what about the small farmer who is 400 kilometers from a market? What assistance can we give to him? Must you not look at the kind of a subsidy, a rebate or something like this? Because if you look at the costs of a small farmer produce food, to bring this thing to the market, at the end of the day, cost say 50, 60 rand for a carton of apricots. What it cost is 30, 40 rand. It's cost for that box is 2 rand 60. And at the end of the day, there's nothing. So I think, and you your research, you also must look perhaps at that to see how we can make it possible for the small farmer to produce foods on the markets. I think we must look at the kind of subsidy. Go to China, if you go to other parts in India, they are also looking at this, as you are aware of, to see how they can create a small farmer. Because the important thing is, Jay, we must make certain that the small farmer produces food. But we must also make certain that there is the success of the small farmer is there. Because we say small business in India is the success story of India's economy. We can also say that the small farmer, if we assist him, can be the success of producing food in this country. And I want to hear what is the remarks of that.
You seem to support them, because this point that you're raising are the points that they have raised. In other words, your question is around the implementation of the policies. No? Okay. Dr. Ravi? No, it's fine.
Thank you, Chair.
All hands up.
Thank you, Chair. I've got three questions. My first two questions relate to HIV/AIDS. On page 3, they say that with nearly 1 million people living with HIV and AIDS having been initiated and treated on the date. Chairman, is this particular figure, with due respect, we've got something like 48 million people in this country, and they say that the incidence of HIV/AIDS in some of the provinces are, you said, we're only second to Botswana. But I'd just like to query the figure there of 1 million. I'm sure it's higher than that.
Sorry, Doctor. I think that what they were saying, I just want you to put maybe your question correctly, is that it's on page 3, actually.
Yeah, that's right, yes. I'd like to question the figure there.
In other words, it's the people that have been tested. That's what you say.
But I'd like to know if they can give us a guesstimate of how many, because the HIV/AIDS is one of the threats to our economy. I mean, a number of very skilled young people become less productive and they die because of AIDS. And the second thing, Chair, yesterday I was in a debate, in the sports debate, and all the parties were very critical of Love Life. They said that the money that we spend on Love Life and so forth, we're not getting the results that we should get from Love Life. I mean, all the parties said that they should think that we should review the fact that we are giving money to Love Life. And I'd like to have their views again. And then thirdly, Chairman, rural development and land reform. I think this is a very complex issue, but to me, I think we must distinguish between subsistence farming and commercial farming. And at the moment, I think that I'd like to have the views from the professor or the doctor there to say that aren't there more mechanisms to streamline commercial farming? Because, I mean, I think some of the other people said it's working in Japan, it's working in India and so forth, and I'm sure we can devise strategies to make subsistence farming, to change that into commercial farming. I'm sure there's a market niche for these particular subsistence farmers to enable them to become commercial farmers. I'm sure there are certain sort of segments which we should explore. They mentioned something like India or China, but I'm sure that we have a market niche in this country too to convert subsistence farming into commercial farming. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Dr. Rabi. Just do this, everyone has it. Maybe what we should do, let's start with the whip, comrade, and then he will be the last honorable member. Let's start with
that. Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to direct my first question to Dr. Jacob. And thanks. Doctor, there's something that's happening now with urbanization, where we see people moving from rural areas to urban areas, and they continue with their tradition of agriculture in urban areas. And that's very good, although it seems not to be addressed a lot. It has a good of positive impact because it feeds the families. But I would like to know whether you've gone any further to look at the at its impact in rural areas, in urban areas, whether it should continue or the municipality should look at it in a certain way. So, and I think that's so far my only question. The other one is on land reform, but I don't know how to put it. Maybe I'm still going to try how to put it because my lecturer will see some mistakes in me and realize he didn't teach me very well. So I'll still construct it somehow. So, and I'll go to the other one was on HIV and AIDS, on how life, what, how do you think when there are donors from different, even if it's inter foreign donors or from other departments like sports, as I was with Dr. Rady in one budget vote, how should the accountability be? Should it remain with health and life, or should they love life directly account to those sectors which will be very fragmented? Because I think it's a problem of accountability. I just wanted to know how you saw it, because it really causes concern. Everybody will look at life doing all these things, but at the end of the day, when the donor departments feel that there's no impact, and maybe the foreign donors will also feel the same, how should the accountability line be so that we should have proper service delivery in this issue? Thank you, Prof.
Thanks, Chair. In one of the papers in this very informative book that you gave us, it's saying that the number of households that were just farming subsistence has reduced in favor of households that are trying to produce a surplus. But later on it speaks there that only 6% of those households that are farming in that manner are using fertilizer and 2% agrochemical. Now, I don't know if there's been any kind of costings that have been, because this committee is it's very interesting what you're telling us, and it informs us, but this committee is dealing with the kind of rands and cents to try for budgets to be influenced. Now, surely if the fertilizer and the agrochemicals increase in those small kind of farming operations, your productivity or your outputs are going to increase accordingly, and a critical mass will come about whereby there will be surpluses will bring markets, etc. Now, I don't know if any research has been done to say, and of course also you're saying the extension offices, but is there any kind of rands and cents being attached to that with a model to say, if it is put in like that, these kind of outputs can be achieved, this can have the effect on rural economies, etc., etc.? Thanks. And what would that number be if it is there?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the presenters for such highly exciting presentations. I would like to ask the doctor was presenting rural development, is it Dr. Jacob? I would like to know if from page 9 on the rural development, you have highlighted implications, and which I think are the challenges which are highly facing the government as far as rural development is concerned. And I would like to know if these inputs were they made during the MTBP. Did you make those? Were you part did you make this during your invitation? I mean, this research and the challenges, were you, did you make them to the budget minister during that time whilst the issue of allocations were made? Because for me, these are very serious implications. And I can see that you have made some projections, but there are still additional funds that have to be involved or asked for us to be able to meet all these policy implications. So for me, this is very, very serious and critical. So I would like to know if you made some inputs and what is it, what is the plan on of government in all this so that they can be able to meet the objectives and the goals of the 10-point plan. Thank you. And then from the HIV and AIDS side, I see now medical male circumcision as an HIV and AIDS prevention. The department is now going to embark on the strategy. Now, I would like to know, because I don't see anywhere where you stress the fact that even if males have gone for medical male circumcision, they have to condomize. It is not going, this is going to bring more confusion that if you have gone through medical male circumcision, you won't be affected by HIV and AIDS. Because we are still at a stage where no one knows exactly what causes HIV and AIDS. So I just want to know, like, why I'm asking this is because there were perceptions, like, where it was said if the girl is a virgin, if we have sex with that girl of that age, you'll be cured. Now, I would like to know what is going to happen to the challenges that are going to come through this statement that is written here. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation. I am quite interested in the over 50-year people that are not coming for testing. A study was done by the University of KwaZulu-Natal in the 90s where they were doing, they were testing males between Maritzburg and Durban. All these males were trackers, and 3/4 of them were HIV positive, and they were 45 and above. The question at the time was, what about their spouses? Because I think maybe their spouses do not go for testing because they think, you know, I've been behaving myself. But the other question to this one is, have you looked at the truck stops and testing and many other things that could be done to assist in prevention? The second question is, Doctor, you said Botswana had quite a lot, more than half the population tested. In fact, South Africa is second to Botswana. In this instance, where does Uganda stand from your research? The last question, the funders. You did say that the Department of Health funds HIV research and other things. And also the Department of Social, you were talking about LabLife. Does it fund LabLife, or it funds LabLife and other things? For instance, the University of KZN is working on indigenous technologies or something around that towards the prevention of HIV towards the prevention of HIV. But also social development also funds LabLife. So LabLife is funded from all angles. Finally, a simple, the last question, last but one question. there is a notion that one garden, one family, everywhere, even in the cities. I'm in my mind, I even have a problem as to how is this going to be catered for? In what way do you think it would be catered for? And finally, you had said, if I heard well, Doc, there in South Africa there are about 5 million people infected with HIV. But up to so far, only 1 million have received are receiving antiretroviral treatment. Do you think are we doing well, or we can do more? I think.
Okay, thanks, Chair. Well, thanks very much. I think the was a good presentation, quite refreshing. And probably, Chair, as you said, that our only enemy is time. We would need to have a little bit more interaction. But let me just follow up on the question around the that Umama just ended up with. The question around the HIV and AIDS and the program. The figure that you present is a global figure. Is a way to disaggregate in order to understand the figures. There is also this prevalence around mother to child in order to see, in order to look at the focus program around that particular issue, because there are also some concern around that particular program in terms of the magnitude and the rollout cover. So if you could comment on that. The second one is on the rural development question. On the slide number 8, there is that 40%, 10%, 80%, and 25%. What I want to understand, maybe, Chair, is to actually look at the narratives, because I think we need to decode the coded language here so that we understand it clearly. So maybe the narratives of this particular work will help. For an example, if we say more than 40% people live in the rural, but we have 10% that are economically active, there's an issue around the poverty, there's an issue around the cost to food. So the last time I think you did make a comment when you made a presentation around the affordability of food, I think you spoke about quite shocking figures that 80% of people can't afford food, or 50%. My memory can't serve me correctly. So I just want to understand this particular slide in relation to economic active poverty, as well as what is suggested here. What do you mean typical close to 80% that people are involved in agriculture? But at the same time, that's a huge number that you're talking about. But earlier on, there's only 10% that is actively involved. What's the relation with that two figures, including the figures of poverty and affordability in terms of food? Will, if you answer that question, will that question not then necessarily go to the heart of the kind of policy? Earlier on, you spoke about what is investment, 6 billion, 8 billion the outer year. Wouldn't the change in answering the question in terms of the research that you've done, would it not influence the policy in terms of what then constitutes a program around food program? I mean, I think member Heldebrom raised the issue about China. He speaks about China. So
China program around food, planting of rice, for an example. So I just want to understand that what in relation to the policy, what then would be the approach. Thanks, Chair.
No, it's fine. Dr. Jacobs, there are your questions. But also, you know, just if we put again for somebody, this percentages of access, 21% in that year and what do these figures mean? Do they mean 21% of the population, 21% of people who are HIV? What is it that they mean? It's like 2008, they grow to 90%.
Thank you, honorable members. We appreciate all those questions. To start with, Chairperson, you did acknowledge the lateness of the invitation. We are also sorry we tried to put up a team so that we'd cover the other issues. Unfortunately, the two of us are based in Cape Town and we're able to reorganize things. But so we'll be able to carry on with you know the exchanges as other members have requested. Let me start with the chair's question because it links up with the first question I was asked, and I'll pass on to Dr. Jacobs. The table showing HIV testing. Saying exactly that. How many people reported in the survey that during the previous year they had undergone an HIV test? In fact, it wasn't the previous year, sorry. And previously in their history, there is another question which asks about the previous year. The proportions are much lower, about half of what is shown there. So it's just going for a test. It doesn't mean that everybody who goes for a test is found to be positive. Unfortunately, with our surveillance system, we haven't been able actually to keep a record of what the outcome of that process is. I think it would be very useful. I recall in the case of Uganda, which was cited, that yes, they've been at it longer than both Botswana and South Africa. However, in terms of the proportion of the population that had been tested, they are nowhere close to where South Africa and Botswana are. So the 21% or 50% are not talking about people who are HIV positive. Overall, we say our national prevalence is about 11%. And it varies by province, it varies by race, it varies by sex for different age groups. I think that was in the presentation done by my CEO in October. So about 11% is the national average. Of course, it is higher or lower in some groups. For example, in universities now, there was a study where they found only about 4%. If I can move on, the issue about the 1 million figure, basically these are statistics available to to us from the National Department of Health, which has collected information about how many people have initiated treatment. I hasten to add, we do not know how long people actually carry on treatment. We just know how many people have started. So the cumulative total is that. Probably it might also include people who have recently died, because the records take a bit of time to update. In terms of what the need is, we estimate about 5.5 million people are living with HIV and AIDS in our country. So probably another million or so people would actually require treatment even using the old guidelines. It estimated about 1.5, 1.6 million people. Now, with increasing the cutoff point, the threshold to 350 CD cell counts as what is needed now, it means the number will actually increase further. Right. In terms of PMTCT, because these are related, so I'll mishmash them as I go. It is true that there have been some challenges in implementing what is in effect a very effective program. There are some success stories in some provinces, particularly where we are. Tremendous progress has been made to reduce transmission of HIV from mothers to their babies. And it's almost at international levels comparable to Botswana and Namibia, by the way, have been more successful than we have been. But we are working on it. And there's also room for other provinces where there have been challenges in implementing what is an effective intervention, because it's evidence-based, to show that instead of mothers who are HIV positive and are pregnant passing the infection to one-third of their children, that can be reduced to less than 10%. In fact, in some countries in the West, mother-to-child transmission is non-existent anymore. So that's the ideal, that with luck, at least some provinces will start to get closer to that, as Botswana has also successfully shown. And I'm sorry if I keep referring to Botswana, because it's our neighbor. I think we can learn from each other. There are things they learn from us, too. In terms of love life, it's difficult to answer the question fully, because one has to understand the landscape in which we operate. There are many interventions happening out there. You know, there are many organizations which are all teaching some intervention. So it is hard to single out one particular intervention and say, yes, this is what has caused some of the gains that we have seen in the data that we have been collecting over the past 7 years. But because most of the changes have happened among young people who are the main target group, we think that campaign, together with others, collectively rather than it alone, has had some contribution. What is also interesting from the results that we get is that although that intervention is meant directed towards youth. In fact, they mention a specific age group, maybe 12 to 19 or something like that. But even those of us who are elderly in our 50s plus are aware of that. So the reach of that intervention is actually quite wide. But in a way, we probably ask, although some, I will admit, when I first saw some of the campaigns, it's like, now what are they trying to say? But it is that process which is important. Maybe for young people, some of that stuff makes a lot of sense, whereas for somebody who is older, you need actually to sit back and say, what are they trying to say? So in short, I would not say there is tangible 100% proof that that program alone is responsible. You have to bear in mind the target group includes, for example, school children. We have said there's a life skills program in all schools. How each of those contribute to some of the changes that are seen in the behavior of young people, no one really can tell. Okay, I want to try.
Problem was the money allocated into who the account. Yeah, it's just, oh, you still coming to the last
one. Thank you, ma'am. Yeah. The next issue was accountability. As I indicated, it's commendable that our government is able to provide some funding to organizations, NGOs like Love Life and Soul City, among others. In fact, there's funding which is going on to other NGOs as well through both the Department of Health and Social Development. The issue of accountability is one which the sector has struggled with, because at times they are big funders with their own agenda. People who come in with a lot of money. I'll give an example. For example, PEPFAR from the American government. And they have been doing wonderful things, because without their resources, we would not be talking about 1 million people being on treatment or the other things we are doing. However, even themselves, they later found that it was problematic to come and say they want to do this separate from the programs of the government. So particularly with the change of government, or that is coincidental, with the new administration, there is actually an undertaking that they have to work hand in hand the government of the country concerned that is being supported. So in essence, some consultations are now taking place which were not taking place 3-4 years ago, where in effect some of the big donors were doing commendable work, but they were working in parallel to what, you know, the government of the day was planning to do. So in terms of Love Life, since there is now this local contribution, and quite a significant one, it only makes sense that they should be accountable to government to start with, because even some major funders also want to work together, closely together with government, so that we can actually implement the National Strategic Plan as government wishes. So I think we have moved. About male circumcision, yes, it will be a major challenge to actually explain to people what partial effectiveness means. The studies showed that not everybody who was circumcised did not become infected. In fact, 4 out of 10 people became infected in the studies. And these are carefully done studies. So in real life, the proportions might actually be different. The basis of the campaign is that there is this strong scientific evidence that at a population level, by doing the circumcision, and if it has to be done safely, and it has to be a full circumcision. If it's done well, that we are going to reduce up to half of possible infections that might take place in men if they were not circumcised at all. But then there is that other half. How do you take care of it? It would be nice if everybody was able to use condoms, all males were able to use condoms, and females later on, because there are female condoms as well. If one perhaps knows for sure that every time they want to have sex, they are going to use a condom, then there is nothing perhaps to worry about. But humans being humans, even if you get circumcised, we are saying there's a chance you might get infected, and hence why they are promoting both male circumcision and the use of condoms. And the benefits are not only on reducing HIV infection. There are other benefits pertaining to other sexually transmitted infections, as well as also benefits to female partners in reducing certain types of cancers. So yes, it's one of those tough issues, and the communication experts are actually currently working on behalf of SANAC to actually figure out how they do this. There has been pilot sites done, for example, in Orange Farm, where they've been fairly successful. And we understand that men are rushing there. But you are right that this might give people a sense false of security that, you know, now they have a license to do as they please. But the way it should be done and the way government is promoting it, as it will be implemented, for example, in KZN, it's meant to be part of a package which emphasizes other things other than just HIV. So if it's understood in that light, then maybe there will be many more benefits other than just HIV. In terms of trackers and spouses, Yes, there actually are programs which are being run, even at truck stops. I know through provincial governments, for example, I'm aware in the Western Cape that there are projects being done along the N1 on the way to Johannesburg. There are projects, but they are targeting the drivers only. Indeed, part of the challenge is what do you do with spouses? And the work that some organizations are beginning to do, actually, just like in workplace settings, they try to expand it to also include spouses. In fact, like in the mines, they have actually now even extended provision of ARV treatment, not only to the workers themselves, if they are males or females, they are female mine workers, but they're extending whatever services to spouses as well. It is a challenge because these people are mobile, but there are these truck stops where programs have been set up with support from government funding through provinces, essentially. But let me be a little bit picky because there were many questions. Sorry if I don't understand. Yeah, exactly. Okay, love finding, the issue was about other research like on traditional technologies. I think there is some funding which is available through Department of Science and Technology, which is supporting some of those traditional technologies. I think let me stop there. The food security issue perhaps will be addressed by my colleague. Thank you.
Thank you for all the wonderful questions. Very interesting. And some of them, unfortunately, are questions that still require quite a huge amount of work because we don't understand all the issues yet. Now, in the interest of time, what I try to do is to sort of kind of look at the questions. I have quite a huge load of questions, and I try to cluster the questions into four or five different groupings or different areas. And the five main concerns, I think, are the following in terms of my understanding. The first one is kind of land acquisition. I mean, that's how people get access to land. The second one would be farming and accessing markets. The third one, I think, is probably more important now than the first one. It is farming inputs. The fourth one would be the linkage to food security. And number five is probably concerns around urban agriculture. Now, let me start, preface my response to the various questions or responses to the various questions with the following, I think, caveat or note or footnote. Traditionally, and I've been, I think, one of those people who adhere to this particular position, that we've characterized South Africa as a country with a dual agricultural system. What I mean by that was that you have two agricultures. You have a commercial agriculture, and then you have subsistence agriculture. And that kind of simplistic view, I think, we, over the last 3 to 4 years, a lot of our research indicated that we've got to move away from that simplistic view. The country is changing very rapidly in the countryside. Actually, we are now beginning to think and talk more in terms of three or four different types of agricultures that we have in South Africa. Being commercial farming, then there is this category of people who make a transition into so-called emerging farmers, and then we have these land reform beneficiaries who are sort of straddling between being emerging farmers and subsistence farming, and then you have this category of subsistence farmers. Now, to just put it, to simplify ideas, how many of these different categories of people do we have? Based on the research that we report in that journal and some of the recent work that I'm busy with and that I've been busy with over the last week or so, we know more or less the national official data is very imperfect that we're getting from Status A. We know for certain that we have at the moment, based on the 2007 agricultural census, approximately 35 or 37,000 commercial farmers or people classified as commercial farmers. We know, more or less for certain, probably, that we have about 250,000 to 300,000 farmers who can be classified as so-called emerging farmers, small-scale farmers. Right. A lot of them have been beneficiaries of the land reform program. And then we have a large pool of people, you know, probably 3.5 million people who subsist or do engage in some kind of farming for own and food production. And these are subsistence farmers. So the critical challenge is to move, and that translates, that 3.5 million would translate into approximately 2.5 million households. And that strategy there would be to make a transition of some of these people into surplus producers where they can, you know, supply into the market, raise an income, employ people, and so forth. And that is, I think, the key challenge. And overcoming that challenge, making a transition of just a small percentage of people from subsistence to surplus production is what where the state can help. That's what the current programs can do. Now, most of the existing support services are not coming through. Well, most of the support services that really enable people to produce and farm sustainably, they're not being provided through the state programs. They are actually being provided through the commercial farmers association or farm producer associations. And that is very important. So what is happening there, and I think we've got lessons, we can learn lessons from the way that farming and agriculture production is happening in the commercial sector following the liberalization of the agricultural sector in South Africa post-1996. Right. I think there are three characteristics. First one is commercial farm production is very, very well organized. You have very strong commodity producers associations, national ranging from livestock type, such as the National Wool Growers Association, through a variety of different crops, Potato Producers Association, Mango Growers Association, and so forth. And these are very strong associations. And within those associations, you have the pooling of knowledge and expertise, as well as the provision of certain support services, such as agricultural support services, high-quality agricultural support services. Right? And I think that those are the key lessons, that high-quality, high-skilled agricultural support services and strong organization. And that, unfortunately, is what we're lacking on the side of the subsistence farmers, and getting subsistence farmers to make a transition from, and especially those who are capable of doing it, the small percentage that we've computed and estimated in the region of about 250,000, more or less 10% of subsistence farmers, households, subsistence farming households, could produce, a surplus if they get additional support, specifically in those two areas, the institutional organization of those farmers, and then the other one is the extension. Now, the institutional organization is specifically about two issues. First one, it's not about only accessing markets. It's about the reduction of the cost. Two types of costs. And one of these costs would be the cost of inputs. And international research and South African research, like commercial farms as well, that if you reduce the cost to fertilizer and other very, very critical inputs that raise productivity, then you will definitely raise productivity. However, the statistics that we report in the study referred to show that indeed the farmers at the moment, especially those who must make the transition to surplus producing farmers, they have very low utilization of purchased inputs, very, very low. So the figure of 6 to 8% of them using it, that's probably also an overestimation. I mean, it's also based on the imperfection in the statistics. So how can you sort of improve access to these people in terms of, purchased inputs? However, in the latest round of purchased inputs might not be the only strategy to raise productivity. In a recent report that is going to be released in September, and I just returned from a major conference on this report in Nairobi about 2 weeks ago, which is called the Rural Poverty Report by the International Fund for Agricultural Development, 20 people from across the continent, or what they refer to as leading experts in the field, debating on alternative strategies of trying to reduce the cost to farming in order to produce a greater surplus. And there is increasing attention being paid to farming techniques and strategies that we call ecologically sustainable agriculture. I'll repeat that. Ecologically sustainable agriculture. Now, there's very limited research in South Africa in that particular domain. Quite a bit of research in other parts of Africa, a lot of research in countries outside of Africa, Latin America, and so forth. And what this essentially means is that you've got to devise ways of how you utilize your inputs and an integrated farming systems conducive especially for smallholder farmers that will limit the utilization of ecologically harmful inputs, reduce the carbon footprint, while at the same time, try and raise productivity. Now, I'm not going to go into extensive examples on these types and forms of support, but there can be a simple system developed to do that. For example, in Malawi, the existing system of seed support to farmers using a voucher system is one of the things that we can expand on by saying, well, okay, if you utilize more of the inputs that's sort of generated through your own farming, we'll give you support in a variety of different ways, for instance, to get your produce to the market. Because a larger market will bring more income to a farmer and enable people to get out of poverty, which is one of the key, I think, objectives and goals of the government. So I'm making a very simple point. The menu of options to reduce the cost to farming, input costs, and the menu of options to reduce the styles of farming or the strategies of farming, they're expanding, and we've got to explore these things. Unfortunately, the investments by the state in the ARC would also be, I think, considered at this stage to be inadequate specifically in this particular area of ecologically sustainable farming and agriculture. I know that my colleagues at the University of Fort Hare, for example, are specifically interested in working further, in experimenting with these kind of techniques. And this brings me directly to the issue of urban agriculture. Because you were using your inputs, fertilizer, but manure and so forth, in an integrated farming system within the local farming domain, you are likely to be able to farm on a much smaller plot and on a much smaller scale. Now, I have done very limited work on urban agriculture, specifically in Cape Town, and it seems to be working. In fact, we are beginning to explore the role of urban agriculture, and we are working with the Department of Rural Development in that area, the role of urban agriculture in two areas, your ECD centers, the early child development centers, as well as your food and nutrition feeding programs. In other words, we're at the school, you can actually kill two birds with one stone, excuse the harsh language, but you can actually do two things at the same time. You can provide nutritious food to children, yes, while at the same time providing education about agriculture and deal with the issue raised about drawing more youth closer back into farming. I've been to a lot of the colleges, for example, and we're working with the Department of Agriculture on the issue of upscaling the rural development colleges, the kind of programs and the education provided to the extension officers at the moment. If you look at what's happening in the rural areas, besides the neglect of the level of the colleges and the extension, but the existing education curriculum should provide for these kind of interventions. My colleagues in Kenya told me that in Kenya, it's part of the school curriculum to have a food garden at every school. So it's not only one family per farm, but every school, a food garden to have this integrated notion of food security, agriculture, and education. This is possible. At the moment, our programs are all very fragmented. So you want to give the children peanut butter and bread in the food nutrition program. Now, my colleagues in the MRC and the colleagues in the Knowledge Systems Unit under the direction of Professor Lavadarius, we are now investigating, you know, really the efficiency of that way of spending state resources. Unfortunately, those colleagues couldn't attend. But that is an area, I think, that needs to be investigated further. So I've dealt with the issue of land acquisition, farm access and markets, farm inputs, and linked to food security and urban agriculture in that little story. Thank you.
Our life, you know, I think both issues, both subjects are connected, HIV and food security. security. Obviously, we have heard that if a person is HIV positive and difficult for that person to take medication on an antihistamine. But I think that for us, we will be from now, from this input, identifying departments maybe that we may have to reinvite in order to look at the abstract plan as to do they stick to this. And I think that we are very grateful about the input and the research that has been made. Maybe we're not meeting as often as we should be, but this committee, the function of this committee is really to deal with the issues of expenditure, but also the impact of this government program. And I think that this input then becomes useful to us, whether in this what has been said and how the issues that you're raising are being addressed. And I think that members have had a question. But honorable members, maybe we'll talk about it later, because I see that the program has been changed from we were supposed to debate on the 4th of June, now it has been brought forward. Yeah. Now, I'm just thinking because we said we would like to invite the other sections within, but I think that we do have some things we'll let you know. Would like to thank you very much, and we don't mind if you send. We'll take it as this input as a bonus, but if there's more meat, we would really appreciate it. Thank you very much. You are allowed to join us, but we would like the other team to come that side. If you want to join us, then you can shift the chairs, and we allow them so that they can speak to their... I don't know if they would like to come this side or would speak from where they ask you to. But it would be interesting to listen to the Public Service Administration. Yeah. Let's just take a 5-minute break and allow themselves to set up their system. Let's start. I know that after 12, people will start panicking. And if he wants a class at the Jacob, he presses starting and resuming next week. He's welcome to come and join us. Where is your team now, Dr. Kitchen? No, it's an important person, that one. He was sitting here. When you come back, he goes. Well, Dr. Kejima and the team, Chairperson of the Public Service Commission, thank you very much for coming. I know you yourself have also been invited at short notice. But to us, you are a very important stakeholder for service delivery. Because unless we begin to understand whether the employees that we have, the officials that we have, are geared to deliver on the appropriation that we have, it's going to be difficult to move forward, because we need to know now whether we have the right people to deliver. But also, I think in your last presentation, you raised issues of let alone behavior and conduct of people, but also the vacancies. We're dealing also with, we have noticed when we dealt with the Division of Revenue, some departments raising the issue of vacancies. I mean, some of the, and also we're dealing with the quarterly report, that some work has not been done because of vacancies that are somewhere. But on the other side, we understand that the government under-collected, and there's need for them to save. But now, we're seeing a trend that as a committee we're not very comfortable with. We support government department savings. But if that saving is on the, I mean, on failing to fill the vacancies, it becomes a problem for people to implement the program, because sometimes there are critical vacancies that have not been filled. We would like to hear from you, from your opposition, and appreciate the reports that were given to us recently. But I don't know, members in the past few months, they've been very busy. I don't know if they've been, started reading those useful documents. But once we do that, we will invite you on them, because we think that they are important reports. Well, maybe we should allow you to present to us.
Thank you very much for the invitation. In the Public Service Commission, we always welcome the interaction with your committee. And even though you gave us short notice, we thought we should respond accordingly. And we view really these interactions as a work in progress for both the committee and ourselves, to try and look and close the gap between the understanding of the mandate of this committee and also the action program of the Public Service Commission. Is work that the Public Service Commission doing, can it answer specifically to some aspects of the mandate? I think for us, this is a very important aspect to consider. The presentations we had earlier today emphasized the point that the priorities of government are very appropriate. I think the Commission also would agree with the relevance of the priorities of government. But we also would agree in increasing the budget wherever that is possible. But the other side of the coin is that the Public Service Commission is tasked with looking at questions of effectiveness and efficiency. It doesn't follow that when a subject matter is as important as HIV/AIDS, that when you just keep on increasing the budget, you will solve all the problems. So I think that is the part that the committee and the Public Service Commission need to look at. Quite apart, of course, from the questions of the impact that have been spoken about. The other sort of introductory comments that I thought I would make, Chairperson, is with relevance to the bill, because I saw that on an annex of Schedule 1 there, it is reflected that the Public Service Commission's budget is now part and parcel of the budget of the Public Service and Administration Department. Now, that matter, we've been tasked with in the Public Service Commission. We did respond to the previous Minister of Finance when that matter was raised. But also the ad hoc committee of Parliament, which said to review the Chapter 9 institutions, including the Public Service Commission, did make recommendations that we aligned ourselves with in terms of the budget of the Public Service Commission, in the sense that we all feel that for the independent institutions like ours, budgets should come directly from Parliament. So we support that view, because quite apart from the fact that we need to be seen to be independent, you will find that a lot of perceptions out there, when the executive defends the budgets and everything else, then I think this independence becomes quite elusive to people that are sitting out there. So we support that view. We therefore think that this measure of putting the budget under the Public Service and Administration hopefully is an interim one, because prior to that, the Commission had a separate vote, which perceptually others may see a much better situation than actually to become a program of Public Service and Administration. But we have had the support of the Ad Hoc Committee, as I say. We also have had the support of the Portfolio Committee on Public Service and Administration on the matter, and I think that they will raise the matter at appropriate time in Parliament. So I just needed to make that clarification so that we know where we come from. I would let the DG make the presentation and we can take it from there. The DG.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, honorable members. In this presentation, I will not introduce the Public Service Commission. The Chairperson has already done that, but I think just to go directly to the tasks that we dealt with here, it's having received a request to comment on the performance of the public service over the last...
If I may interrupt you, are you now, you're no longer in Hollywood now, am I right? You are.
No,
we did promise the committee that on the last occasion that would be rectified. Either we had to chase him out of the department, appoint a new one, or confirm the DG. We did the latter, and we've never looked back.
Thank you, honorable members. The task was to look at the performance of the public sector during the past financial year. Draw some comparisons and looking at the state of readiness to take up the new budget, and there was a request that we should specifically lay emphasis on the five priorities of government. The colleagues from the HSRC have already reminded us in the earlier presentation what those priorities are. Just to talk about the approach that we use, especially noting that the meat that we usually get from annual reports and audited financial statements for 2009-10 have not as yet been published. We sought to look at the key trends along certain key indicators that could give this committee a sense of the institutional issues that affect readiness in the department. And given the size of the public service, we said, well, let's look at a sample of departments. As opposed to trying to cover all more than 140 departments. Let's look at a sample of departments, and the sample selection was guided by the five priorities that the committee said we should focus on. So you're talking about education, health, justice and constitutional development, correctional services, South African police service, rural development and land reform, which was previously land affairs. Obviously, the understanding here is that the priorities themselves are cross-cutting. So if you look at corruption, for example, almost every single department has a role to play in the fight against corruption. So the choice of this department is in no way a suggestion that they are the only ones that will be responsible for these priorities. It's just that we realize that we're facing an elephant. And the question was, how do we, with due apologies to vegetarians, eat the elephant? And we thought the focus should be on a sample of departments that could give members a sense of the performance trends. We looked at this critical indicators. We looked at financial management, and we looked at previous annual reports and audited financial statements of this department. We also looked at the interim financial expenditure report for the period ending February 2010, because that's the information that was publicly available. But also service delivery outputs, the proportion of outputs that were achieved as reported by the department, human resource management, using annual reports and PSC records, and ethics and anti-corruption. We believe that these are very critical institutional issues if you are assessing the state of readiness in a department, because if there is capacity for effective financial management, to achieve service delivery outputs, effective human resource management, and a high level of professional ethics, you are at least this is what happened to Prof. You from where? It's a virus that has been left here. But these are quite important. Now, it's a fairly lengthy presentation, but we'll just cover the highlights, honorable members. Just starting with education.
understanding, of course, that now it's been divided into two, it's basic education and higher education. Looking at financial management, you see in the 2007-08 financial year, expenditure trends at over 99%, 2008-09, 99%, and expenditure as at the end of February 2010 at 96.6%. Now, Treasury reports show that the benchmark as at end of February, spending pattern was 91%. So education slightly above the benchmark, but which suggests that there may not be a need to worry at this stage in terms of the extent to which they will be able to utilize the budget for 2009-10. A key issue to look at is looking at 2010-11, according to the proposed appropriation there, an increase of, if you take basic education and higher education budget together, an increase of what would constitute 80%, actually. Now, the issue is the department ready to take up that amount? Well, if you look at the previous financial years, the department has unqualified audit opinions, which is a very, very useful indicator in part. And the Auditor General did not highlight any negative issues in terms of performance information provided by the department. But in terms of their outputs, they only managed to achieve 62% of the output that they have set for themselves for the 2008-09 financial year. The reasons they give the non-cooperation from provinces, financial constraints, high bids from service providers, therefore affecting their ability to contract service providers on time to deliver on this output, lack of human resource capacity and delays occurring due to shifts in priority. So one of the issues that would then need to be looked at is to what extent has the department been able to deal with these kinds of constraints that impacted on the achievement of the output during the 2008-09 financial year. On the side of human resource management, as at end of March 2009, there was an 18.8% vacancy rate. We raised the issue of performance management because for departments to be effective, they must hold the officials accountable for the delivery of the outputs. So we track the issue of the signing of performance agreements, particularly the level of SMS members. And you see in the Department of Education that for the 2008-09 financial year, all SMS members signed their performance agreements, which is a good thing. Sorry, senior managers. Senior members of the senior management service. Yes. Another issue that we raise, of course, singling out the head of department, the director general, because in terms of the SMS handbook, once the performance agreement of the head of department has been signed, it has to be filed with the Public Service Commission. So if you look at those 3 years there, starting 2006-07 to 2008-09, the performance agreement of the DG of Education was indeed submitted and filed with the Public Service Commission. Next to filing the performance agreement is performance assessment, whether the performance of assessment of the Director General was done. For 6-7, it was done. 7-8, 8-9, the performance evaluation was not done. And again, we raise particularly that of the head of department because it starts there. If you have performance a culture of accounting for performance at the level of the head of department, then you can expect that it can cascade down. But if it doesn't happen at that level, then it raises questions about what is happening in the rest of the department. Still with human resource management, in terms of labor relations, a useful thing is that when it comes to disciplinary hearings, we don't have a huge problem here, which is the case in other departments where people are on suspension for extended periods of time. Here in the Department of Education, 8-9, you see average number of days suspended is 13, which costs the department 9,000 rand. Compared to other departments, it's a fairly low figure. The grievances received also a fairly low percentage there that were lost in 2008-09-13. Those referred to the Public Service Commission in 2009-10 financial year, only four, the majority of them relating to performance assessment, the very issues that we are raising that make sure that effective performance management and accounting for performance takes place in the department. We look now at the issue of ethics and anti-corruption, and we start with financial disclosures. With the work that has been done by the Auditor General showing that public servants do business with departments that employ them, if we are going to talk about the readiness to take up new budgets, we have also to look at whether there is a high standard of professional ethics that is being promoted in the department, so that the resources that are allocated to the departments are actually put to good use. Financial disclosures, 83% of senior managers filed their financial disclosures. This increased to 93% in 2009-10. Quite high compliance rates, although, as you know by now, the Public Service Commission always says only 100% compliance rate when it comes to financial disclosure forms will be accepted, because it's a very basic compliance instrument, and we shouldn't allow a situation where even a single member of the SMS does not comply. We also look at national anti-corruption hotline cases, allegations of corruption that are received through the hotline and are then referred to the department. Fairly low numbers if you look at the Department of Education. 2004-05, only two cases referred to them, none in 2005-06. So very, very low numbers of allegations there. And the response rate there also fluctuating. 2006-07, 2007-08, 2008-09, there's still one or two outstanding cases where feedback is still going to be provided. But none of the cases have been closed completely on the National Anti-Corruption Hotline as it stands now. We also look at financial misconduct. For the last 2 years, 7-8, there was only one case of financial misconduct, and then no case of financial misconduct in 2008-09. Perhaps just to explain that, what we're saying here is that there was no case, finalized case of financial misconduct reported to the Public Service Commission. Because the requirement in terms of the PSMA is that once they have finalized the case, they then have to report to the Public Service Commission. And that is what we are tracking with this department. So in terms of the Department of Education, that is the status. And as part of talking about readiness for the next step, readiness for this budget, the issue then becomes, what are the issues that have been raised here that need to be taken up with the department to say, how have you addressed these kinds of issues to make sure that the institutional readiness is there to take up the new budget. It's the same pattern with the Department of Health. If you look at the spending patterns there, for the last 3 years, 97%, 97.6% in 8-9, as at the end of February 2010, 90%, while Treasury was saying the benchmark at that time was 91.7%. The increase from last year to the one proposed now in terms of their budget is about 16.7%. What does the Auditor General say? For 7-8, 8-9, qualified audit opinions. In fact, if you go to even earlier years in the Department of Health, 2003-04, qualified, 4-5, qualified, 5-6, qualified, 7-8, qualified, 8-9, qualified. What are the issues the Auditor General is raising? We list some of the issues there that were raised in the 8-9 audit. 29 million rand, for example, could not be verified. 23 million relating to national public-private partnership project could not be verified. These are the issues that the Auditor General has raised, and has also raised concerns about information systems, the adequacy of control processes, and those are important things when it relates to institutional capacity. How are they being addressed? They have listed 14 outputs in their annual report for 2008-09, of which 12 were achieved, and the reasons for non-achievement, more or less the same as those raised in the Department of Education: financial constraints, lack of human resource capacity, delays in arranging training at provincial level, and so on. And once again, the issue is, how are these issues being addressed as the department prepares for the new financial year, including the concerns that the Auditor General has raised and has been raising for the last 5 years or so. Human resource management, the vacancy rate was 25.1% as at end of March 2009, which is higher than the one we reported on in terms of education, which was 18%. If you look at the signing of performance agreement, the information is not there in the annual reports of the Department of Health in terms of the percentage of SME members who have signed performance agreements. The evaluation of the head of department, submission of the performance agreement to the PSC 2006-07, it was not submitted. 2007-08, it was submitted. 2008-09, it was submitted. But if you look at the evaluation of the performance of the BG of Health for those last 3 years, that evaluation has not taken place. Still with human resource management, labor relations, it's that we just reflect the number of disciplinary hearings there. 8 disciplinary hearings, 6 of which led to dismissal, a number of people on suspension, 6. And the grievances there, 28 in the 2008-09 financial year, and those referred to the PSC, 8 in the 2009-10 financial year, the majority of grievances, unlike in education, which relate to performance assessment, in health, they relate to salary matters. OSD in particular, because we have been receiving a lot of those kinds of grievances being referred by members of the executive to the Public Service Commission. Ethics and corruption and financial disclosures form for the 2008-09, as at end of April, we didn't receive anything. 2009-10, 69%, very low compliance rate compared to the Department of Education. Anti-corruption hotline, a fairly low number of allegations referred to them, but also the feedback rate to the National Anti-Corruption Hotline being low. No cases of financial misconduct reported during 7-8. For 8-9, there were 9 finalized cases of financial misconduct with a cost of just over 100,000 rand. And the good thing is that the full amount was recovered. Looking at South African police, financial management spending patterns for the last 3 years, 99%, 8-9, 99.1%, and as at end of February 2010, 91%, which is around about the benchmark set by National Treasury at 91.7%. And the proposed allocation for 2010-11 represents a 10.4% increase from their previous financial year. What does the Auditor General say? Well, for 7-8, the Auditor General gave an unqualified audit opinion. For 8-9 as well, unqualified audit opinion. But these are the issues that were highlighted in the report, concerns around information systems, concerns also around adequate control processes that need to be addressed. They reported that they achieved 22 out of the 30 output service delivery outputs, which constitutes 69% achievement of the service delivery output. Reasons for non-achievement include the overcrowding of police cells, restructuring processes that impact on the pace of service delivery, clarification of roles, and the fact that the mandate was extended. On human resource management, the vacancy rate was 0.2%, which is quite low compared to the ones we've already talked about. Signing of performance agreement, no information was available from the South African Police Service. Looking at the evaluation of performance agreements of head of department, no performance agreement was submitted, no evaluations conducted, but here we should also keep in mind the fact that the National Commissioner was on special leave for most of this period. Labor relations, the very high number of disciplinary hearings here, 3,479 with 366 dismissal, highest incidents involving misconduct here, absenteeism, failure to comply with or contravention of the Act, failure to carry out lawful orders, 650 people suspended, the high number of, average number of days suspended, 86. If you keep in mind that The regulations say that if you suspend someone within 60 days, you must have conducted a hearing so that the period of suspension is not extended. There is reason to be concerned that the average number of days suspended is quite high, and the cost of suspension there being over 5 million. To continue with labor relations, the number of grievances lodged over 1,000 in 2008-09, 6 referred to the PSC during that year, 8 referred to the PSC during 9-10, the majority of them relating, just like the Department of Education, to performance assessment. Ethics and anti-corruption, the submission of financial disclosure forms fairly high, 8-9 and 9-10 at 99.8% for both financial years. And for the hotline cases, quite a number of hotline cases referred to the National Commissioner here, and if you look at 2008-09 in particular, where the number of cases was quite high at 144, the department providing feedback in terms of 50 of those and 33 of them being closed. There is movement in terms of the South African Police Service around dealing with the allegations of corruption that are referred to them. And financial misconduct, 29 cases in 7-8, 8 cases in 8-9, and the amount recovered reflected the 27% of the money recovered in 7-8, 61% of the money recovered in 8-9. Justice and constitutional development, just looking at the spending patterns there, last 3 years, 96.5%, 7-8 going up to 99.6%, 8-9. As at February this year, it was 89%, which was lower than the norm determined by National Treasury. The allocation for 2010-11 represents a 24% increase from the previous financial year. And let's look at what the Auditor General says. Qualified audit opinion for 7-8 and for 8-9. And again, if you were to go back to other previous years, like 5-6, there was qualified audit opinion. 4-5 and 3-4 were okay, but from 2001 to 2003, qualified audit opinions as well. And this being the major issues raised in the 7-8 audit report, irregular expenditure amounting to 57 million in 8-9. Irregular expenditure amounting to 69 million, possible fruitless expenditure amounting to 18 million, and the issue is how are these matters being addressed as the department prepares to take up the budget for 2010-11. Labor relations, very high number of disciplinary hearings, loss of state money, insubordination, absence. I think here also to note the average number of days in suspension, 252, again, which is quite high. Relative to what is expected, where there is effective management of disciplinary processes, and also a very high amount of money involved in terms of the cost of the suspension, as reflected in the slide. Grievances, the majority number of grievances for 8-9, 421, and the slide further reflects the numbers referred to the Public Service Commission, and the majority of them, just like the Department of Police, as well as the Department of Education, they relate to performance assessment. Performance information, a number of issues raised here around the quality of the performance information they report by the Auditor General, information systems not appropriate, inadequate control processes, where it is expected that a strategic plan was prepared and approved for the financial year under review, and the Auditor General said, no, it wasn't. A functioning performance management system and ensuring that performance bonuses are only paid after proper assessment and approval, the Auditor General says no, which then explains why, in look at grievances, the majority of them relate to performance assessment. And also in terms of outputs, they reported 75% achievement of their service delivery output, given reasons relating to budgetary constraints, amongst others. Continue with the human resource management here. Vacancy rate was 13.58% as at end of March, and percentage of SMS members who have signed had signed performance agreement for 8-9, 65%, which means 35% continue to manage in their respective sections without the necessary performance agreement. Performance assessment at the level of the head of department for the last 3 years, 7-8, 6-7, 7-8, 8-9, it was filed with the Public Service Commission. Evaluations were conducted for 6-7 and 7-8, and for 8-9, the evaluation is still outstanding. And ethics and anti-corruption, compliance rate, submission of financial disclosure forms, 8-9, it was 95%, 9-10 is 96%, quite high, but that small gap of 4% is still significant for the Public Service Commission. National Anti-Corruption Hotline cases, that table there reflects the cases that had been referred to them. The feedback received was quite high in 2004-05, but it began to go down. You got 2005-06, 06-07, and so on. In 2009-10, 36 cases referred, only one feedback provided, and one case closed in 2009-10. Continuing with ethics and anti-corruption, financial misconduct, the department reported the highest number of finalized cases of financial misconduct in both financial years that we are covering here, 7-8 and 8-9. And the 7-8 figure is 113 finalized cases of financial misconduct, 121 in 2008-9. And we reflect also the costs involved there, as well as the amount that the department has been able to recover from those implicated. Correctional services, spending patterns for the last 3 years, 97%, and then overspending in 2008-09, 103.9%. At the end of February this year, for 9-10, spending was at 89.8%, which was slightly lower than the benchmark set by National Treasury. The increase from 9-10 to the proposed allocation for 10-11 is 9.4%. The Auditor General for 7-8 and 8-9 qualified audit opinion. And in fact, if you trace this back to the earlier years, from 2001-2 financial year, from the financial year 2001-2002, it's been a qualified audit opinion throughout, up to 2008-9. And these are the issues that the Auditor General has raised in terms of the concerns. For 7-8 includes the huge amount there of lack of appropriate evidence to support certain adjustments, 162 million rand, 805 million rand in respect of the 8-9 financial year, the existence and valuation of assets with an approximate value of 236 million could not be confirmed, unauthorized expenditure to the amount of 483 million was incurred, critical issues that need to be addressed by the department. Performance information, the issue around the strategic plan being prepared and approved on time, that was a concern that the Auditor General raised here. And they achieved only 30% of their output, service delivery output for the 2008-09 financial year, giving as reasons, amongst others, awaiting approval of policies, capacity constraints, large quantities of unscheduled work, changes in leadership, and so on. And the issue is how far has the department gone to address these critical issues. Human resource management in correctional services, vacancy rate at 10.7% as at end of March 2009. And here we just indicate that in terms where the vacancy rate is the highest in terms of the different programs, that is 47.6%. In the program that deals with public-private partnerships. Signing of performance agreements by SMS members, that information is not available in the report of the... There we go again. In the report of the department. An evaluation of the National Commissioner of Correctional Services. Yes. In terms of the evaluation of the National Commission of Correctional Services, starting with performance agreement for 6-7, not submitted, but for the last 2 years, 7-8 and 8-9, it was submitted. But evaluation of performance, the performance evaluation has not taken place. for 6778 for reasons known in terms of the provisions of the SMS handbook that the National Commission did not qualify to be evaluated, because you can only be evaluated if you've occupied your post for 12 months, a full financial year. But for 8-9, that evaluation hasn't taken place as yet. Labor relations, over 3,000 disciplinary hearings involving 144 dismissals, number of people suspended, 423, a very high average number of days of people suspended, 77, as opposed to what we expected, that within 60 days the cases will have been dealt with. The amount involved reflected as well, the cost of the suspension to the department. There we just reflect the number of grievances lodged. I think an important thing to reflect here is also that the number, the majority of the grievances, as opposed to education, for example, where they are about performance assessment, here they relate to salary matters. Financial disclosure forms, 2008-09, none submitted to the Public Service Commission. 9-10, none submitted to the Public Service Commission. Quite a fairly high number of allegations of corruption as well, which do not necessarily mean that there is corruption, but they need to be investigated and feedback should be provided to the whistleblowers. But we just reflect that the feedback rate fluctuates. If you look at years such as 2007-09, the feedback rate was quite high, 198, and feedback received 153, 8-9, 165 cases, 43, 9-10, quite low, where only two cases, there were only two cases on which feedback was provided, and only one case was closed. Financial misconduct, number of finalized cases of financial misconduct has gone down from where it was 54 in 2007-08 to 13 in 8-9, and we also reflect the cost of the financial misconduct there. And at least the good thing is that also the money is being recovered. 95% of the money involved in 8-9 was recovered. 76% of the money involved was recovered in 2007-08. This, yes. And in terms of rural development and reform, previously land affairs, spending patterns there, 99.5%, 99.9%, fairly low in terms of 9-10 as at end of March, end of February 2010, it was 69.3%, which was lower than the benchmark at 91%, which was set by Treasury. The increase from 9-10 to the proposed allocation for 10-11, quite marginal at 5.9%. Auditor General concerns, qualified audit opinion for 7-8 and 8-9, and just going back actually for 5-6 as well, there was a qualified audit opinion for the department. The issues raised, concerns raised by the Auditor General are reflected in the slides there. I will not go through all of them. Issues relating to irregular expenditure, for example, which we highlighted in other departments as well. But the Auditor General did not highlight any negative issues in relation to performance information. 49% achievement of their service delivery output for the 2008-09 financial year, and the reasons given for non-achievement similar to those given by other departments: capacity constraints, insufficient funding, and so on. 16.7% vacancy rate for the department as at end of March 2009, and the highest vacancy rate being in the program that deals with surveys and mapping at 24.9%. Signing of performance agreements, this information is not available in the annual report. Evaluation of the performance of the DG, submission of performance agreement to the Public Service Commission for the last 3 years, that has not been done. Evaluation of the DG for 6-7, it wasn't done. For 7-8, the DG resigned before the end of the financial year. For 8-9, no evaluation was done. Disciplinary hearings, five of them, and just giving a breakdown there in terms of the categories of those disciplinary hearings. a number of people suspended 7, an average number of days at 42. And the amount of the cost of the suspensions is reflected there in the slide as well. Grievances referred to the Public Service Commission, 14 in 2008-09 and 11 in 2009-10, the majority of which relate to a new category here, unfair treatment. Ethics and anti-corruption, 2008-09, no financial disclosure forms of SMS members were submitted to the Public Service Commission, 9-10, 59%, which is quite low. And the allegations of corruption referred to the department, the figures are reflected. The highest was in 2007-08 at 17, and followed by 9-10 at 15. The feedback rate fairly low as well for each of the years involved. One finalized the case of financial misconduct in 2008, and partially the cost involved was recovered, 3,000. Was recovered. And in 2008, three finalized cases of financial misconduct, and almost half of the amount involved was recovered. Honorable members, I think just to indicate, it's obviously been very rushed input, but just thinking through this, whilst we've highlighted the areas that impact on the performance of the various departments, and the work can be enriched in future by considering the following. Firstly, it's looking at past performance, as we have indicated in this presentation. But it would have been useful also to look at the quarterly performance reports of departments, which I would imagine that this committee have access to. And because it for 2009-10, the committee will already have seen the rate at which the service delivery outputs are being achieved, so that in addition to the expenditure patterns as at end of February 2010, the discussion would have looked also at the rate at which the service delivery outputs themselves are being achieved. And then also another useful thing would have been to look at the strategic plans that have been submitted to Parliament for 10-11 onwards. Because the expectation is that in those strategic plans, departments reflect on the challenges that they have faced and how they see themselves addressing those challenges once they receive this this budget. And we think that this is work that the research unit of the committee can do once it's been established, and it can generate this analysis. It can be done in collaboration with the Public Service Commission, of course. But for now, we hope that the big that we've been able to bring together will enable the committee to make informed decisions about the budget allocation. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I see hands are up for everyone. Maybe let's start, Honorable Mataka, let's start with you this time.
Thanks, Chairperson. Just two short questions.
Yes.
I find it very problematic that a department would say, like Justice and Constitutional Development, it had budgetary constraints when there's been fruitless expenditure and irregular expenditure. Mm. And then where there were salary problems, was it around the issue or was it in particular with regard to the OSD or other things over and above? And maybe, though this is not reflected here, but from the opening of school campaigns, there is a lot of problems in the within education around the issue of leave. Maybe if at a certain point in time you can look into that. Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation.
Thank you for the presentation. Very good, very interesting, Chair. I just want to, I don't know whether you will have the information, but if you could maybe let us have an indication as to how many of all the departments had qualified audit opinions for the 2008-2009 financial year. I doubt whether you'll have that information right here, but if you can let us have it, I'll be very pleased.
The first one is, I also would like to see what is the SMSs of the provinces when it comes to education. If that is possible and the health. Because I think we must look holistically about that. The SMSs of agreements of the provinces when it comes to education and health, if we can get this. Because I think in every province there is a public service commission office. The second thing is about 24% the correctional services. That is the one on page 18, that 30%. That is not on. What are we going to do on that? And then the third one is that the vacancy rate in rural development, 24.9%. Now that linked with what Professor Jacob said this morning. That was my question early on about the training college, about the food production and service delivery. So I think that is things I want to know. What are we going to do on that? Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Chair. My question is about the PMDS. And I'm as Dr. Jack brought to present the document here this morning, your guy's publication on that I thought was very good too. But in my understanding, the PMDS is there to ensure that institutional excellence is strived for within any of the departments. It's then looking at to see what kind of training, what development must take place in that department to achieve that excellence. The PMDS is also linked to the performance agreement because it's based on the annual strategic plan, really. And it lastly should reward excellence. Okay. The AG, and I agree with him, although Treasury doesn't agree with myself or the AG, they believe that the BAS and PERSOL are perfect systems to be able to monitor performance within the department. And I think that myth has to be dispelled so that we can go forward. Because if that is the case, and there are no systems to monitor performance as it's stated in your slides, how much has been paid on bonuses, performance bonuses? Because if you haven't got a system to manage performance, how can you pay performance bonuses? And what amount of money has been paid over the last year since the system has been implemented on performance bonuses to senior managers? Thank you.
Microphone.
Payments during suspension. Do you see officials on suspension still being paid, and for how long are they being paid? And another clarity that I would like, we know we are going to meet departments telling us about unfunded posts. Will you kindly explain to us what these unfunded posts are? And how do they come about? Thank you.
No, just a small question, just a comment and then small question. I think, Chair, in terms of the first introductory remark that was made in respect of the standing of the commission independent body, I think as a committee we should support that standpoint, that it is actually a constitutional anomaly that must be corrected. So I think we should support that that standpoint, that otherwise it just blurs the independency and of the commission itself. So when I looked listening to the DG presentation, almost all the departments that you've referred to, except one, maybe any constitutional one, justice. In most of the years that you have referred to, there was no evaluation. The heads of department were not evaluated. Now, the question that I want to pose with respect to that, what action have the commission taken in respect to that? Because I think that senior manager, in terms of HOD, they are accountable at two levels. At the one level, they are administratively accountable, and the director general will be the responsible person in terms of helping with some power there. And the second level would be the executing authorities. So what action has the commission taken in terms of making sure that everybody that's supposed to follow the normal rules have followed? And if there is a reluctancy to, there should be consequences to that. So that's really the first question in relation to the heads of department, because when you look at them, all of them, the evaluation is no. It would be interesting to follow up the question about the evaluation, whether there has been any, what do you call, performance bonus paid to that, and what would have been the indicator of the performance bonus, if any, paid. Then perhaps the one other question is this issue about disclosure. The small question around that, Chair, is that also is in relation to action taken, because I think in terms of report, the buck stops somewhere. And what has been the Commission's reminder towards where the buck stops with respect to the disclosure, financial disclosure, particularly? So those are just two questions that I have.
Thank you very much, colleagues. But maybe I should. Sorry. Hold on.
I wanted just to ask.
Who wrote for you that question?
Well, I was writing, but I just couldn't follow. Okay, I see the norm. What would be the recommended norm with respect to vacancy rate? What would you say the norm would be? If the RS is 16%, it varies. From yourself as a commission, what did you say? Because from where I'm sitting, if and the post is vacant for so long, it may not be necessary for that post to be filled. Then what is your view on that particular matter?
But what about the fact that sometimes some of these posts are there, some of them are critical. The PG, DDG, it's not there, it's only one vacancy. DDG for this is not there. So that critical function is not performed. Also, how do we deal with those, what you call it, with those kind of things overseas?
Thank you very much, Chair. In my opening remarks, I was saying that the direction that we need to be moving in is to ensure, like the DG was saying as well, to ensure that in future we are actually going to zoom in on the mandate and really what we need to be coming out or being provided to the committee in terms of its capacity to do what is needed or its oversight function. So I think that for me remains really the first priority. Some of the questions, of course, do indicate that aspect that are being posed here, but I'm not sure to what extent, you know, are we recognizing the gaps that are there between this kind of presentation, the previous presentation, and what really the committee would need. So I think at some stage we would need to zoom in on that. All these questions are very interesting and taxing questions in terms of management, in terms of ensuring that departments are doing what they've been set out to do. The discrepancy between some of the irregularities that we see in the patterns of expenditure here are not in sync with the call for more money that we've been hearing. I think that was the first question that was posed. In my view, one cannot keep on, as I said earlier, calling for more money without ensuring that there is accountability on the aspect that are not being got right by departments. So for me, that is really very important. The number of departments that have qualified reports, I think that information can be gotten. We may not have it offhand here, but I think that information can be provided. Then there's a list of questions, I think, where the question is being asked, what are we to do about the performance agreements of provinces, for instance, the problems with the correctional services and the vacancy rate in rural development. Yeah, I think that really is the question that needs to be put to this department. Now, if you look, for instance, on the provinces and you look only at one of the items that we highlighted here, which is the hotline case, is that you are getting in the case of the provinces, unlike, because these are national departments. Now, if you look in case of the provinces, the amount of complaints that we receive, both from hotline cases and other means of complaints, is that in most of the times they are 20 to 30 times more, because these department provinces are at the coal face of service delivery. So that is where you see the problem in terms of the complaints that are being lodged in the hotline, and also where you see that the response rate of the department is lacking far, far, far behind in the provinces where service delivery is taking place. So indeed, these departments in all these areas that we outline, and in particular the provinces, need to be brought forward so that they can account for the problems that we see here. Now, how appropriate is an instrument or systems like BAS and PESAL in evaluating performance? The answer is that you are right, that these are not sufficient. I think that there's a big gap, that we still live in the public service in terms of what is desirable in monitoring and evaluating performance and what instruments and tools there are here in front of us. Even those instruments that the Public Service Commission is engaging in. There are resource constraints in terms of being able, for instance, to roll out our monitoring and evaluation system throughout the government. We do it in a piecemeal fashion. We choose departments this year, and the following year we choose others. So there's a big gap between what can be done in terms of measuring performance and what is really on the table for us to do. Now, the other interesting question for me was zooming on the questions of the number of HODs that are evaluated and what has the Public Service Commission done, both for that and for the financial disclosure of the form. I think for both these areas, HOD evaluation and submission of performance agreements, year in and out, year out, we produce fact sheets in this area. Year in and year out, we can tell you from the time that these policies were set up to now, the compliance rates of departments. We have these fact sheets, we take them to departments, all the executive authorities get these reports, all parliaments and legislatures get these kind of reports where we show the gaps that are there. We write a number of reminder letters to the departments in terms of them being able to to come to the table for these. We note in this report the lack of 100% compliance in terms of financial disclosure forms. We think that this is not acceptable. That is why the committee that you sit in, also Member Ramatakane, we welcome the decision that has been taken that in fact that particular portfolio committee calls public hearings to focus in particular on these areas to ensure that we have compliance, because the mandate of the commission is indeed to bring all non-performance areas to the legislature and parliament, and for parliament to ensure that that there is accountability and that steps are taken. Sometimes I'm of the view that parliament underestimates the powers that it has, because for me, the very fact that officials and heads of departments can be called to a parliament to account would be enough to ensure that in subsequent years there is compliance. I'm sure there's a number of questions, DG, especially on the technical level, that I've left out there.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think just to agree with the issue raised about the PMDS versus BAS and PASANS, the achieved distancing, PMDS is about the management of the performance of individuals. And BAS and PASANS are organizational systems. So at the end of the day, you can't assess the performance of an individual by using the PASANS system, because the PASANS systems will simply tell you when this person was appointed. It will tell you how many leave days this person has taken. It will tell you when was the last time this person was promoted. Is that kind of employment history? What is the salary level of this person? It tells you. It doesn't tell you about how this person is performing. And the BAS system tells you the same, but on the financial side of the department. So it's the PMDS that says these are the performance expectations that we have clarified between the supervisor and the employee, and these are this is the regularity with which we will review performance against those areas, and this is how we implement it and deal with issues of development that the employee requires in the process. The question about payments during suspension, the way the policy works is that you can be suspended as a precautionary measure. For example, there is concern that you were involved in possible misconduct, and the employer decides that in order to investigate this case without you influencing it, you need to be away from the workplace, so they suspend you. But it's called precautionary suspension, and it's not a sanction. And because it's not a sanction, you can't say it's suspension without pay. But once the investigation has been done and a hearing has been conducted, the outcome of the hearing, the sanction out of the hearing, may be you are suspended for 3 months without pay. But that is when you can be suspended without pay. But yes, a precautionary suspension, which is what happens quite often in public services, precautionary suspension. You can't deny the person the salary, because then it's a sanction. The challenge is that because the hearings are not finalized within the period of 60 days, the policy provides for the period to be extended by mutual agreement, and therefore it gets extended and extended and extended, and it's on full pay during that time. I know that in terms of the issues that the Minister for Public Service and Administration has raised in his budget vote speech, this is one of the issues that he wants to look at closely, based on some of the recommendations the PSC has made in the past. In fact, as part of the 2010-11 work plan of the PSC, we'll also be looking at the management of precautionary suspension in the public service. The issue of unfunded posts, I remember DPSA, DG at some point saying actually that doesn't exist, because you can't say you have a post if it's not funded. You can create a post on your establishment, but if it's not funded, why do you even talk about it as a post? So they come about because the department may realize the need to create capacity in this particular area. But until it is funded, the issue is should we should should we even be calling it a post in the first place? Because you keep it on the establishment, and it creates the impression that there are many vacancies. But you are not going to fill it anyway, because the budget for it doesn't exist. Just the last issue in terms of the bonuses being paid without performance assessment. There is evidence in some of our work, Honorable Ramatlakane, that there are instances where performance bonuses are paid not only without performance assessments being done, but without performance agreements being entered into. When we did a study on which was requested by SCOPA a few years ago on performance management and the payments of bonuses in the departments of labor, correctional services, and home affairs, there were instances where we found that such bonuses were paid without the assessments being done. But we did a follow-up study looking at HODs generally, where we were trying to find out how many of the HODs that have not been assessed have been paid performance bonuses. It's actually a small number. But the fact that, even if it's a small percentage, the fact that it does happen, it's cause for concern, because there's no basis for making that payment. I think the encouraging thing is that it's not widespread. There were concerns at some point that it's widespread. It's not widespread. But the fact that it still happens in some instances should be cause for concern. In some areas, in one of the reports we did in the Northern Cape, it was a decision of the executive to say, let's give a blanket promotion in terms of pay progression without performance assessments being done. And we raised it in that report, but that is irregular, even if it's a decision of the executive, because you can't substitute effective performance management by an executive decision to say, let's effect the payment. And finally, on the vacancy rate, we don't have a norm that we've determined as the Public Service Commission. Again, we took cue here from BPSA, which they haven't formalized as well, but they talk about an average of 8-9% as a common benchmark in terms of vacancy rate. I suppose the issue, as raised earlier, is for what duration? Because if it's an 8 or 9% vacancy rate for 3 years. And at what level? If you have that vacancy rate at the most senior level of the department, then we have to be very worried that it is impacting on the capacity of the department to deliver. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Public Service Commission. I think that Dr. Kitsima raises a very two important questions. One, the link between these presentations. Obviously, with the questions that were raised and as reflected in the report, issues of performance, clear that we are very weak on that, and in some departments, the misconduct are very high. And some of these misconducts, we are informed that sometimes relate to not those that relate to salaries, but those that they're not necessarily the same, you know. Some relate to performance and all those kind of things. But I think that what is clear is, colleagues, the way I see it is that let's take this as a beginning. It's important that because the questions that we are raising, for instance, about what are the then. In the last presentation that you had with us, we heard that departments are not doing this. In other words, in simple language, layperson's language, they are not cooperating as they are supposed to do to report on this thing. But the question is, who takes up that responsibility? Your responsibility only ends in the reporting. This is what has happened over this year. This is the people who have come forward, this has not come forward. You make this report available to Parliament. But I'm not sure as it stands. It looks like there is still a grey area in terms of how to access this report for members. If, for instance, is when the if the Department of Correctional Services do they invite if they want to? I mean, they go about their budget vote, for instance. Do they invite Public Service Commission and say, what is your understanding of this department? And then you give them this report from 2001 up to date. Qualified reports, qualified reports, qualified reports every time. And then it also raises a question about our own oversight. If the department continues to do this thing. You know, and clearly, every day is business as usual. Well, I'm hoping that well, we indicated at the beginning that the time is ending. Not only the time of starting and this committee, we have got a whole, what we call a program that we need to follow. But unless we conscientize people, if we want to deal with agriculture, can we, I don't know if the Department of Agriculture has ever invited, for instance, HSRC to just reflect on this issue, or Department of Health, to say, it's fine for the department to report, but what about just an independent body to say, look, this is our understanding of the issues, of the state of affairs. And therefore, you take it from there. But what I would like to say, I think that the issue that needs to be followed up, I hope that maybe in collaboration with the portfolio committee, is the issue of your budget. Section 196 of the Constitution says, 196.2, the Commission is independent and must be impartial and must exercise its powers and perform its functions without fear, favor, or prejudice in the interest of maintenance of effective and efficient public administration and a high standard of professional ethics in the public service. The Commission must be regulated by national. I'm not sure if that national legislation is there. But clearly, we are not sure about, I mean, you in your report, you didn't indicate to us the processes that led to finally getting your budget being reported under the Public Service Commission. Because it's true that it may compromise or may be seen to be compromising your department. But maybe before we say that, to say if the budget is under your department may compromise your independence, the public service, I mean, on the Human Rights Commission, for instance, how is the budget or the cost? Because I think it's also under the Justice Department and so forth. But I think that they should serve just as conduits rather than the Public Service Commission or Human Rights Commission accounting. It does not account to the justice, to the Constitutional Department it doesn't account to that. Your Auditor General, there's no budget for the Auditor General. but the Department of National Federal report on that, but they are not necessarily, in fact, the Auditor General reports directly to Parliament. All of you, the independent institutions, are supposed to report directly to, to account to Parliament, not to a department. Maybe it's something that we need to do a follow-up on. I have mentioned the issue of the correctional services, this audit opinion. But the other question that was raised is before we get to that, I don't know, you didn't mention, for instance, your budget, whether you didn't raise questions about your budget or complain, but it seems that the budget itself is fine. But what you're not happy with, what you're not happy with is where it's located. I hope that it's not a problem. But really, colleagues, and for these institutions that are supposed to support us, are supporting us, I think that maybe it's important for us when we invite them. See, if you invite people on Friday, you'll get very few people to support that. Because what we're beginning to do as a committee, if we're dealing with a particular department, to also invite those people from the department. I think that what we need to do as well, so that we can raise the profile of this institution. Sometimes not many of us understand what is the Public Service Commission. How would Public Service Commission assist our committee? I'm talking about each committee. Or how would the HSRC assist, for instance, this committee and those kind of things? Maybe this committee perhaps can also assist in doing those things so that in future people can, just out of their own initiative, invite you to assist them. The issues have been broadly what we call covered. We will invite you again, not now, not for the purposes of the appropriation. Hopefully, if we have time after that, just to deal with those issues that you have raised with the portfolio committee, or maybe with the portfolio committee, and get to understand them. Or else give you a feedback. Colleagues, I think that the last thing is the program. I hope that everyone has got a program, the change program, which means that we really, from the 4th, on the 4th, in fact, we're having a BUSA, Unity of South Africa. The program says submissions by general public. There's a submission by someone here that we have received. I'm sure members will be given all the submissions once they are combined. Then there's COSATU, there's identification of departments. And I think that maybe we might use that period for departments to invite again the I mean, those people that we think that we still need more information from them. On that note, may I take this opportunity to thank everyone for coming and the HRC for sitting throughout. The public service as well for sitting throughout as well, because you started with the meeting. We're looking forward to working with you in future. Colleagues, thank you, those of us who are still here. Next week, I understand that it's a constituency period, so we don't have a meeting. Honorable Mashefo, you have a class. I do qualify. I'll be back here for a class next week. By the way, Dr. Jacobs, the classes have started. Anton, you will be invited.
I know. I know, and I'm looking at the results.
Enjoy your weekend. A long weekend. Yes. Thanks.